Okay, so we'll being I'm a football coach by trade, I'll say we'll kick this lesson off with exactly what is a what is discipleship. If you had to define what discipleship is, you would start it off by saying it is someone who looks like what? A disciple, a discipleship is someone who looks like, and I put a few scriptures up here. If I can get three people, look up Luke 9, 23 and 24, Matthew 7 and 12, Luke 14, 25 and 34. It'll be a hint as to exactly what a what discipleship would emulate or look like. So, I guess if we had three facets here, we would say discipleship is someone who, anybody have the first one, Luke 9, 23 and 24?
And he said to them all, if anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for me will save it.
Okay, good. So he must embrace humility, right? Is that pretty fair? So discipleship is someone who is going to embrace humility. I know what humility looks like, and I know what arrogancy looks like. And I think as we get through the lesson, I think we'll figure out that there are sometimes I think even ministers fight some of that because they get into the busyness side of the ministry, and we've got to be careful as to which way we go. We don't want to tilt from humility to arrogancy. Second one is in Matthew 7 and 12. Discipleship is someone who has Matthew 7 and 12. Anyone?
So in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you. This sums up the law and the prophets.
Okay, that's pretty simple. Discipleship is someone who treats others exactly the way they want to be treated. And that's hard to do sometimes. But the second point in discipleship is pretty simple, is someone who treats others just exactly the way they would like to be treated. None of us like to be treated unfairly. Number three, Luke 14, 25 through 34. If someone had that, discipleship is someone who looks like, who mirrors what? Luke 14, 25 through 34.
Large crowds were traveling with Jesus and turning to them, he said, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, his wife and children, his brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. And anyone who does not carry his cross and follow me cannot be my disciple. Suppose one of you wants to build a tower. Will he not first sit down and estimate the cost to see if he has enough money to complete it? For if he lays the foundation and is not able to finish it, everyone who sees it will ridicule him, saying, this fellow began to build and was not able to finish. Or suppose a king is about to go to war against another king. Will he not first sit down and consider whether he is able with 10,000 men to oppose the one coming against him with 20,000? If he is not able, he will send a delegation while the other is still a long way off and will ask for terms of peace. In the same way, any of you who does not give up everything he has cannot be my disciple. Salt is good, but if it loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is neither fit for the soil nor for the manure pile. It is thrown out. He who has ears to hear, let him hear.
Okay, good. Thanks, Marcus. That was a lengthy one there. So, what is discipleship? Discipleship is someone who embraces humility. Discipleship is someone who treats others the way they would like to be treated. Not just when it's going good. Not just when they agree with me. Treat someone or treats others the way they want to be treated. And thirdly, as Marcus just read, total submission to and learning from who? Jesus, the Master. Total submission. Totally submits to and learns from the Master at any cost. Now that's where it gets a little tough. Because we're in the selfish world. I know I am. You know, sometimes it turns all about me, which is a scary thought. But I think if you really dig in, and that's kind of where I start. I start from kind of the root and say exactly what is discipleship. And what does discipleship look like? What does it look? What does it exactly look like? What does it? One of the characters that come to me from the Bible terms or from the Bible examples is a disciple, a person that emulated discipleship was Mary. And then on the flip side of that, one that didn't emulate that so much was her sister Martha. Can y'all help me with that? You know, remember, we're going to have thin questions and thick questions. This is a thicker question here. So how would Mary emulate discipleship?
She put aside maybe everything and just went to his feet, where Martha was running around like a crazy woman trying to prepare her house.
Exactly.
It didn't matter. It wasn't the self, you know, that didn't help her salvation or her relationship with Jesus.
Right. She was working her way into, and you bring up a great point. What happens when we get so busy with work, 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 check, 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 check? What happens to our focus? What exactly happens to us when we get caught up in the checklist or the busyness of life or ministry? What's wrong with that?
You lose the end goal focus. You're just looking for the next check mark.
Right. Could you experience burnout? Flame out. Why would burnout or flame out happen? I mean, we know we're commanded to do works. That's not what we're saying. We understand that part of it. But if we get caught up in Martha's busyness or her checklist, what happens to us? Whose power do we start operating on? If you think of it like that.
You're never going to be able to do enough. So
yeah.
You'll burn out.
Yeah, we kind of operate on our own powers. And once we start operating on our own, what happens? We kind of lose that rudder. We lose our focus. Even though we're trying to do something really good for God, we've learned that the secret is letting what? We've got to let God what? In discipleship. We've got to let God work.
Lead
through us, right? At the end of the day, he's doing the work, and we're just the what? Kind of the vessel, I guess you would say. And then we alluded to Martha's example, which would be on the flip side. As we enter this lesson, my daughter's reading this book called Undaunted, and we were visiting yesterday morning, and this kind of made sense to me. God doesn't call the qualified. He does what? He qualifies the called. And that kind of made it really simple for me. God doesn't call the qualified. He qualifies the called. What does that mean? What does that look like? In your world right now, what does that look like?
Well, it means I don't have to go to seminary to minister to somebody.
That's right. That's a good thing for me personally, I'll tell you. In other words, he wants to what? What does God want to do?
On the job training.
That's right. On the job training, working through us. When we started this morning, I was mentioning to a few that were already in here, you know, being in the teacher mode, which fortunately at Carroll, they don't let me teach anymore in the classroom. it's all about small groups now. Why? Why is it about small groups now? How do we communicate today? I mean, we all know it, text, Facebook, Instagram, all that stuff, and we forget to what? Verbalize in our communication. So in dealing with a football team today, I sometimes feel like I'm talking to robots because they just sit there and look at me like, you're really verbally communicating right now? I'd rather have it in some type of text or email. And that's foreign to me because I'm a little more old school. But we lose the essence or the fragrance of what? The personalism in it, the relationships in it. And that's kind of where we're going to go from here. The heart of a disciple, I guess, is where I would like to start this morning, is why do you personally want to make a disciple? Why do you personally want to make a disciple? We talked just a couple of minutes about exactly what discipleship is. And we've talked about it's someone who does embrace humility, who treats others the way they want to, who submits and learns from the master at any cost. We've spoken just briefly about what we get wrong about discipleship. We talked about Mary and Martha there. So if as we enter this, what does it look like in your world right now, discipleship? If you just had to pause for 30 seconds here and say, what does discipleship look like in my world? And then why do I want to be a disciple? You going through that a second? Where would you begin? In big group or a small group? With your neighbor, a family member, or would you try to get to a bunch of people? It's pretty simple question. Where would we all start? Smaller group. Why? Why would we start in a smaller group?
To build people's trust if they're going to follow you.
Right.
It's less intimidating.
Less intimidating, more comfortable,
and more familiar.
More familiar. What kind of world do we all like to be in? Comfortable or uncomfortable? You're exactly right. We like to be comfortable. So as we start this, have you ever asked yourself that question? Because it's really important. As followers of Jesus, we should be focused on making disciples. We all know that. And I'm gonna paraphrase some of this, some of the thoughts we entered in with a lesson plan, and I kind of deviate, as most people know. But here's where it gets sketchy or tricky a little bit. We've got to go in the discipleship attitude or frame of mind or focus with the right motives, the right the goals. If we don't, we're wasting our time, totally wasting our time. We should be doing more harm than good if we're not focused on the right thing. What does God care more about, the external things or the heart of the matter? No doubt. Where do we sometimes lose focus? Where do we sometimes lose focus? Yeah. Right now, my wife sold her house. That's the good news. Okay. The bad news is we have to find a place. But I was thinking about this lesson because when I go look for a house, what's the first thing I'm going to look at? The very first thing I'm going to look at. The outside. What's the appearance? What's the curb appeal? How significant really is that in a house? I mean, in the big scheme of things, what's the most significant thing? The bathroom, the garage. Yeah. Does it have a swimming pool? Yeah. But really, when you dig into it, what's the most significant thing about a home? The foundation. The foundation. But what do we look at second or third normally? The foundation. You know, we'll let someone else do that, and we'll trust them with obviously so. But that kind of brings to forefront with me personally. The most significant thing, the most important thing in discipleship is where's your heart? Where's your foundation? And that's where it gets pretty sketchy too, because we want to be around people that we're comfortable with. You know, does our friendship matter the most, or what they're wearing or their appearance? Did it matter to Jesus? Or who is the greatest disciple of all? Who's the example of all? I mean, simplifies it pretty much. At least it does for me. If God cared only about religious activities, then who would be number one from Bible terms? Who was the most doing group out there? Pharisees. Why? What do we know about the Pharisees?
They were a pit of vipers.
What?
They were a pit of vipers.
All right, pit of vipers.
They like to be out in front of people making a show and all about them.
Yeah, it's all about me. That's right. What do you know? So would you call them leaders or would you call them followers? What kind of people, what kind of attitude did they?
Self-absorbed.
Self-inflicted kind of people. The Pharisees, I guess they would have been the heroes of faith, so to speak, in appearance alone. They were continuously engaged in ministry. Would you say they really adapted to outward demonstrations or more inward demonstrations? Obviously, that's not a trick question. There's a lot more outward demonstrations of godly godliness. They made sure everyone around them knew they had all the answers. They were holy. They were diligent in teaching God's law. Yet the gospel always presented the Pharisees as villains. Pretty fair. So does a disciple need to be a leader? Yes or no? No. What does a leader seek to be? There are managers and there are leaders, right? In my place of employment, there are managers and there are leaders. And there's a significant difference. And we have to ask ourselves, because I think there are two kinds. A manager, what's the difference in a manager and a leader? Anybody want to know?
For me, tell people what to do. Leaders show them.
Okay.
Yeah. The manager boss will have to light a fire under you, and that leader will light a fire in you.
Right.
That's how I've always looked at it. And it, of course, it goes back to the sports background and everything. That's always been a big deal for me.
A manager may not have any followers. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
He may lead it from behind instead of leading from the front.
Right. Anybody else? In other words, a manager wants to be heard. That's about it. A leader seeks to be
seen.
Yeah. Understood. Was Jesus a leader? Did he seek to be understood? What did he do to be understood? What did Jesus, what did Mary, what did they do to seek to be understood? And there's a difference, right? Can you think of some examples? What did Jesus, what could he do to make us understand? Why do we follow Jesus? Hopefully it's because we understand, you know, we're understanding what we're following. That'd be sad if we didn't. So what did Jesus do to help us understand?
He led by example.
He led by example. Miraculous events. He died for us. I mean, that's pretty significant, right? If someone would turn to Matthew 15, verses 8 and 9. And with that thought, we know the Pharisees devoted their whole lives to activity, kind of like we mentioned with Martha. She, an important theme runs throughout Scripture in regards to this. So if someone has Matthew 15, 8 and 9, could you read it for us, please?
This people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far away from me. But in vain do they worship me, teaching its doctrines, the precepts of men.
Okay, thank you. So what makes the difference? What makes the difference? God wants us to pursue certain actions. Is that fair? I mean, there are certain actions he wants us to pursue, but there is something significantly different between the Pharisees' attitude and being a disciple maker. What is that difference? Or what does make the difference? Our heart. Good.
I think Jesus showed more on the standpoint what you were saying earlier. His big standpoint was his priorities. He showed you how to prioritize your life, and also in the hard times, what to do first. I mean, he had a prayer life that was unquestionable, and I think this just following that example of prayer, starting off his day with prayer, always getting alone with prayer, through hard times he prayed. I mean, his example was really depending on God, and I think that, like you were saying about the house and things, that first, if we depend on God, he said, everything else will be added to you if you seek me first.
That's great. Perfect. Because it's going to be, at the end of the day, what motivates us, right? What motivates you to go to work every day? Well, I want to eat. You know, I've got a family to provide for. I want stuff. I got payments to make. Well, we know God gave his son as the supreme sacrifice for us, which that's a pretty big investment, totally committed to this deal. So what makes the difference to me is all the motivation that we go about it and who motivates us and why they motivate us. Now, as you become into being a disciple maker, can teaching be a little bit dangerous at times? I know it is for me. It's a little scary. Why would teaching be a little bit scary sometimes?
You're held more accountable.
Exactly. In our world today, how accountable do we want to get? How involved do we want to get? And outside, just kind of a press, you hear people talking about someone else, and they're your friends, gossiping for better word. What do we tend to do?
Join in.
Either we join in, and if we just stand there and listen, we're involved now, and we're a victim. Or we just walk away, which is that's easy to do. Or what should we do many times when we know it's nothing but mere gossip? What should we do? I mean, but we don't like what in today's world?
Conflict,
confrontation. Why do we not like it? Because we get involved now. And, you know, being a football coach, and you're, when you play football today, it's a very physical, reckless sport, and you've got to get totally involved in it. But in life, sometimes we choose not to get involved. I wonder if that has anything to do with the state of our country sometimes, because of lack of involvement. So as a disciple maker, being a disciple maker is always going to start with some type of relationship or involvement. Fair? It has to. How do you get involved with someone you have no relationship? Okay, what's the key ingredient to a relationship? If you had to say one relationship, and I used this in a class before, but we're all, most of us are married, right? What's the number one ingredient in a marriage? Trust. Is trust pretty important? Okay, can you sort of trust your mate? Think about it. Can you sort of trust them? Or do you have to? You can't sort of. Either you do or you don't, right? So in being a disciple maker, there's got to be a relationship of trust. And I think that's why we always kind of go starter with smaller groups, maybe a family member or a friend or things of that nature. Okay, so why do you want to make disciples? Get a little thought here. Why do you want to make disciples?
You believe in Jesus, so you want to invite people and want them to have the same opportunity to care about their soul. If you really believe, you would make disciples.
Caring. What else?
We're commanded.
Commanded. We want to be obedient. Exactly. Why else would you want to be a disciple?
We want people to have a personal relationship with Jesus, like we were talking about teaching. Sometimes that's a slippery slope because people will teach from their perspective, and that's their calling from the Lord, not necessarily somebody else's calling from the Lord, and people might follow the wrong path and not be listening to God themselves. So that teaching disciples is truly teaching somebody how to have a relationship with God themselves, not just following the bandwagon. Imagine if we all followed the Pharisees.
Oh boy, yeah.
You know.
Good. What else? Okay. Why do we want to be disciples? All three or four great examples. So we've got to make a huge investment, right? And we have to make a very strong commitment. How many times do we really like to make strong commitments and investments? So it's hard. I mean, let's face it, it's really hard. Do you think the devil knows that? Absolutely. But sometimes we can be committed to our spouse and our kids, which that's all intertwined and good stuff, good relationships. But why do sometimes we shy away from investments and commitments? Why would we shy away? We want to be a disciple maker. We know where to follow for all the great reasons you gave, but sometimes why do we shy away from it?
It's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work. It takes our time. It takes our time. And the world teaches us to do all this other stuff. But when you get involved, when you're going to become a, or when you are a disciple maker, or you are a disciple, commitment, investment, time, involvement, relationships. So at the end of the day, we are, once we become all these things we've talked about, we are to minister out of, as the lesson says here, we're to minister out of joy, right? And I hear Scott talk about it in the pulpit some. You see people come into church and they've got their game face on, you know, kind of that solemn face. But God teaches that we're to minister out of joy, right? Why? Why joy?
Because we have good news to share.
Yeah, we got good news to share. We're happy people. Why are we happy? Why should we be happy?
We're excited.
We're excited about what? Why are we excited to be here? Because we're supposed to be here. We have to be here. How good it works. You know what? When I hire coaches right now, I say, if you have to be here, I don't want you. You get to be here. You get to be around kids. You get to invest in child. You get to watch video. You get to. Isn't there a difference, significant difference in have to and get to? So we should take the attitude of gratitude in that we get to be here. We get to fellowship with one another. We get to learn from life experiences from each other, right? And most importantly, we get to learn more about God's word and what he has for us instead of coming in here with, well, I've got to punch the clock here. I got to be here this morning. You know, I got to go in that class this morning and talk about discipleship. Someone have 1 Peter 5 and 2 handy? 1 Peter 5 and 2. And 2 Corinthians 9, verse 7. 2 Corinthians 9, verse 7. God wants us to minister out of joy, not mere, here's a bad word, obligation. I mean, do we love on our kids because we're obligated to? We've got our what in it? We got our heart in it. We've got a huge investment in it. And we should take great pleasure in ministering to others. What God's done for us, how he's impacted my life, how he's impacted your life. That's pretty powerful. It's pretty significant. But someone have 2 Corinthians 9 and 7 handy? Anyone?
Each man should give what he has decided in his heart to give, not reluctantly or under compulsion.
Thank you, Morris. Willingly and eagerly. Willingly and eagerly. I get to. Okay, 1 Peter 5 and 2.
Shepherds of God's flock that is under your care, serving as overseers, not because you must, but because you are willing, as God wants you to be, not greedy for money, but eager to serve.
Eager to serve. If, as we move along, for those who are eager to lead, remember that God wants us to be cautious as we lead. Remember that you will be teaching people about the Bible and guiding them into godly living. The Bible takes the role of our teachings very seriously. Fair? And that's where it gets a little slippery. He takes the role of our teachings very seriously. Now, what's the greatest teaching we can get? Is it by sitting and listening to a minister? Or is it by watching someone's example?
Mary and Martha.
Yeah, Mary and Martha. There you go. For me personally, I'm a visual learner. I have to watch. You can draw a play up all you want to, but I have to see it in action. So I don't know where you are in your world, but I know for me personally, I'm a visual learner, and I like to see lessons like that. I like to learn from things of that nature. What's the strongest muscle in us, right? Or what's really untamable? The tongue. Tongue's pretty much untamable. So the tongue's really powerful. But so what are we going to verbalize with? What are we going to communicate with? How are we going to teach? We're going to teach with our tongue. So we know sometimes it's pretty untamable. It's pretty tameable when everything's going my way. I mean, I'm pretty easy. You know, when an official makes a bad call, I'm really focused on just being a good role model there. Not really. You know, why? Because it doesn't what? You know what? I'm gonna get off the road here. I have to pray about that a lot.
Yes, sir.
because when officials do something that really aggravate and annoy me, because, you know, we never make a mistake over on our side of the ball. I know that official's out to get us, you know. But aren't we the same way in our world right now? What if someone's disrespectful to your own child? And I'm telling you, in my world the last several months, I've really, really had to pray about that. I've really had to pray about that, because some things inside of you we want to get even sometimes. You know, we want to inflict things that, yeah, and it really tests your faith. I'm telling you, it really tests the river you're in. I know it has for me personally. James gives us a very terrifying warning about the power of the tongue. While we can speak truth and bring life to people, he warned us that our words can also do incredible damage. Relationships are destroyed. Churches are destroyed today because of our own personal perceptions, our own personal desires. The tongue is untamable. In James 3:6, James said, "The tongue is capable of diverting the direction of our lives, producing deadly poison, and setting on fire the entire course of life." James 3:6. That's pretty stout. That's really stout. James even accused the tongue of being set on fire by hell. "If you look at your heart and even find a trace of desire for the glory and prestige that come through teaching and leading other people," take just a little bit of time to let James's warning set in. And does that kind of put us in a safe mode sometimes, where we really don't want to stretch out a little bit, maybe? But at the end of the day, that becomes an excuse, doesn't it? You know, it becomes an excuse. Stepping out in the sports world again, you know, what always has annoyed me as a coach is when a coach or a player start blaming someone else. That really bothers me, because I think that's a cowardly attitude. It's not my fault. You know, I did everything right. It's his fault. But we're in the world today of when you get down, I see kids in school so many times. It's always going to be someone's fault. You ever notice that? If my kid doesn't learn, it's the teacher's fault. Right? It's not my fault as a parent. It's got to be the teacher's fault. He didn't make an A, it's the teacher's fault. We didn't win every game, it's the coach's fault. It's not my fault. My kid didn't play enough, it's got to be someone. You see what I'm saying? If the building's not full, it's got to be the preacher's fault. I have nothing to do. It's got to be the elder's fault. Have you noticed that's our world today? Why do we do the blame game? It's easier. It takes the what off of me. Yeah. Well, I'm not coming to worship today because I'm not getting anything out of it. Y'all heard that before? I mean, to me, that's sad. That's really sad. Is that a courageous way to look at things, or a cowardly? Let's just cut to the chase. I mean, what is that? It's a cowardly way to look at things. It's assuming no ownership. And I mean, you know, in sports, there's win and lose. There's always a victor, right? Well, you know, in the Christian walk, which is a very disciplined lifestyle, we all know that. We chose it. We chose it, and what a great choice. I would hate to be somewhere. I'd hate to be going through life without faith, without hope, for me personally. With that being said, we've got to assume ownership, which requires investment, commitment, sacrifice, a disciplined lifestyle. Being a disciple maker, being a disciple of Christ, is a disciplined lifestyle, and it's an investment. So we've got to, as James says here, we've got to be very careful and assume or take responsibility for his warnings. Okay, moving along here. What comes first in discipleship? There's always a first. Now, I'm one of these people, you know, there's always got to be one, two, three. You see these bullet points. So I'm just one of these guys that the clock, that clock being turned sideways bothers me a little bit. So what comes first? What comes first? Rule number one in discipleship is what's got to come from your heart. What must come from our heart in being a disciple of Christ?
Be willing.
Be willing to. Okay. What is God?
Love.
So what comes first in discipleship? Love. God is love, right? So the first thing that comes in discipleship is love. How hard is it to love people that don't do something for you? Yeah. How hard is it to love someone that's harmed you? Man, now you're getting, man, we're getting on thin ice here. I mean, that's difficult. You think the devil knows that? Oh, yeah, he knows it. He knows it. Love comes first. Paul added a challenge from a different angle in the most beautiful terms. I like what he said. He said that gaining knowledge and power, even sacrificing our own bodies, is totally worthless without love. Paul said that gaining knowledge and power, even sacrificing your own body, is completely worthless without love. Love conquers a lot of things.
Personally, yes. You have to love Jesus more than the outcome or your pride. So you have to be willing to be yourself, and whatever that person thinks of you after you share your testimony, you have to love Jesus more and know that the bigger picture is more important than the superficial whatever's, you know, like the enemy comes in to shut you up.
Great. She says vision. Mm-hmm. Use the word. I love that word. As a leader, as a disciple, we've got to get others to see the vision Jesus has placed for us. What's our ultimate goal? Our ultimate vision is to get to heaven. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that has to happen. So many times we get caught up in future things. What's God say about the future? Yeah, he'll smack you right in the face. But you know, that's where we get caught up in. But you know what? I've learned this through life. You always start with the vision in mind, because if you don't, you're not going to reach it. You're not going to get there. So, does someone have 1 Corinthians 13, 1 through 3? 1 Corinthians 13. 1 Corinthians 13, verses 1 through 3. I'll go ahead and read it to save time. If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I am a noisy gong, or I am a clanging cymbal. And if I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but do not have love, I am absolutely, I'm paraphrasing, positively nothing. I'm nothing. Without what? Without love. I mean, that's pretty simple. It doesn't say what if, could be, whatever excuse I can give. Mama didn't get me up this morning. She didn't do everything for me. Without love, I'm absolutely nothing. If I give away all I have and I deliver up my body to be burned, but do not have love, I gain nothing. So, what is the result? What's the result without having love? In teaching others, in being a disciple maker. What is the result without love? Because love is an investment. Love is a relationship. In order to love someone, there's got to be some connect. You know, we you know, lip service. I can give you all the lip service. Well, I love you. What are you talking about? I don't even know you. What is the result without love? I'm a clanging cymbal. I'm nothing. I gain nothing. Are we the type of people that can teach? Is that that's the bell to go, isn't it? Okay. Are we? Does that mean time to go? Right. Okay. So we'll start. next week we're going to start with what are the signs or symptoms of a loveless heart. There are some definite symptoms. There are some definite signs. And when you go through this, it's always, it kind of starts jabbing me right in the heart because I'm, that's kind of, I know where he's coming from right here because there are signs and symptoms of a loveless heart. Let's end with prayer. Appreciate so much. Hope it wasn't too boring to you. Some of these things that you look at, we get pretty passionate about, and I hope you do as well.